listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents Humility, Love, and Power. The sermon by the Reverend Gene Randall Bodman, presented on Sunday, August 28th, 2016.
Now, the thing that struck me forcibly about this week's set of lectionary readings was the theme of humility. Humility is an old-fashioned virtue, and it's gone out of style. In fact, it's not just out of style, it's considered quaint and a bit foolish, and perhaps even suspicious. A tool of those in power. If the already powerless can be indoctrinated to be humble, the rich and powerful will have a much easier time staying rich and powerful. But humility has not always been viewed this way. The rugged individualism that our American culture loves to praise itself for did not always exclude humility. And we talked about this at the Tuesday morning Bible study. And as I mentioned, as recently as my childhood, it was not just the concept but the word humility that was taught. It was still in fashion, at least in my Calvinist neck of the woods. I acknowledge that my family was a little strict. My loving, doting parents would scan a report card that I brought home that had excellent grades on it. And they would point out the one grade that fell a shade below the mark, and they would cock an eyebrow at me and ask, "What happened here?" Now, as a child, I found this extremely frustrating. The one less than stellar grade became the focus, and I went away disappointed in myself. Now, I wouldn't recommend that particular style of parenting, and I've had to bite my own tongue a few times to keep from using it with my children. But when I asked my mother about it years later, she said, "Oh, I don't know. I suppose we just wanted you to know that we knew you were a good student, so all your grades should be good. We didn't want you to get a big head about it. After all, you're not responsible for having those native abilities, just like it's not your fault that you have no manual dexterity. You came that way. It's up to you to use it well." In other words, do not go getting too big for your britches, Missy. You are not all that. While I still have uncomfortable moments thinking about those B pluses, I think there was something valuable in my parents' attitude. As old-fashioned as it was, I believe we are poorer as a culture for losing sight of that. I'm wondering if there are other old-fashioned virtues that you can think of that have gone out of style in our culture. I was watching an old-fashioned kind of PBS show about the characters were set in the 1880s, and one character said to the other, "We must forbear." I had to go look it up. I didn't know what it meant. But I think it's a good virtue. I think there are many that have gone out of style that we would do well to consider again, like forbearance and patience. But as for humility, I remember my sense of distaste and dismay when a coworker with whom I was becoming friendly as a young adult, invited me to join him for an evening meditation with his faith community, which was called Self-Realization Fellowship. I thought that was shocking, and I remember being appalled the first time I saw a Self magazine on the bookshelf. Now, I would not want to insult Self-Realization Fellowship and the people who are members of it. I never joined or became an adept. And it is not just possible, but likely, that my friend had a very shallow understanding of what they meant by self. That they, in fact, were talking about a larger sense of universal self rather than individual self. But he was talking about individual self and telling me how great it was, how big you were going to feel afterwards. At the time that it was presented to me, it struck me as so selfish, so self-oriented and self-focused, as to be the opposite of spiritual. As a former Calvinist who is also a feminist and a product of the late 20th century education, this whole conversation seems fraught with peril to me. Because it is true that the concept of humility has been used against women, against African Americans, against people with less education, to keep us in our place But I would also like to suggest that there is something beautiful and joyful about humility. When God says to us, be humble, the point is not that we should feel small or useless or worthless. It's that knowing ourselves already to be beloved, we are free to stop thinking about ourselves at all. I remember vividly Baby Bible 101 with Phyllis Tribble at Union Seminary. Professor Tribble was a very intimidating professor, but there was one class when she gave what amounts to a sermon, and it was a sermon on the book of Job. She was focusing on the idea of pride, and she said to us, pride is, in general in our culture, more of a temptation for men. Not always, but more. But don't get complacent, ladies, women, and some men, because the flip side of that coin is just as bad. Self-abnegation, self-abasement, self-loathing, the opposite side of the pride coin, is just as bad because it keeps the self eternally focused on the self, which is tedious and limiting and frustrating. The central passage for today is from Jeremiah. Now, Jeremiah was a prophet who preached in the late 7th and early 6th centuries BCE. He preached in the kingdom of Judah just before and after Jerusalem was destroyed and the leaders were taken into exile in Babylon. He was preaching against the other prophets, the feel-good prophets, who said, it's all good, we're going to be fine. Jeremiah's message was, it is anything but good, we are not going to be fine, the kingdom is going to fall, and it's going to be our own fault. We deserve it. It's where we get the phrase Jeremiah'd. And the passage that I read today is a rebuke, certainly. That aspect of the text is very easy to hear as Jeremiah delivers God's message to the people. I accuse you. I accuse even your children's children. But what we might miss if we focus on the accusation is the longing. God remembers the early days of God's relationship with the people. He remembers the devotion, the loving kindness of Israel's youth, Israel's love as a bride. And then God asks, what went wrong between us? What wrong did your ancestors find in me? We note in God's declaration in chapter 2, I remember the hesed, the loving kindness of your youth, the love of your newlywed days. Now think of all the ways that newlywed married couples show loving kindness to each other, the tenderness, the loyalty. This is what God is longing for and missing in God's relationship with the people. The proof of this kind of love is action, not just words or feelings alone. Now, some parts of the ancient narrative, that narrative of the people traveling through the desert with Moses leading them, some of that story may tempt us to wonder why God sees that people's loving kindness. Why God sees Israel as loyal? Because as you remember, when the people got into the desert, they immediately whined about the food, and they thought maybe they'd like to go back. And when Moses spent too long on the mountain, they made an idol for themselves. Nevertheless, this is how God remembers Israel's love during the wilderness, as tender and loyal. And ultimately, the people's loyalty did come back to Yahweh. They belonged to each other. Now, this early passage of following God into the wilderness and learning again and again to trust God brings us to the illogic of the people once they get into the land. God says, you followed me into and through the wilderness, where, from a common sense perspective, it did not make sense to follow me. But you loved me, you doubted me, you came back, and I provided. Then, after I brought you into this land of plenty, you forsook me. And that makes no sense either. God has in mind this memory of the loving kindness and tenderness between himself and the people. And he says, they distance themselves from me. When love grows cold, one of the first visible symptoms is emotional, physical, and other distancing of the former lover. The old closeness fades. And just like any other spurned lover, God asked, what wrong did I do? Why would you do this? Why would you leave me? Here God introduces Israel's second head-scratching vacuity. It wasn't enough to forsake the one who loved them, the only God who actually is God. They did that, and then they went after vanity, or meaninglessness. That's how the word is normally translated. But that's only the outcome. The essence is, the word refers to vapor, something vaporous. Now you see it, now you don't. Something like mist or smoke or breath on a frosty morning. Something named as Hevel is not necessarily vain or without worth, but it's temporary. It's very fleeting and transitory. Forsaking God, Israel became transitory and temporary because it put its trust in temporary things. God says to the people, you were created for permanence. Making any created thing into a god rips it from its rightful place in the created order and turns it into vapor. A vapor that disappears even as the worshipers call on it for help. God alone is permanent. At the close of today's passage, Jeremiah uses this beautiful imagery of the living water that the people forsook in favor of dry, cracked cisterns. Now, life in Israel's central highlands was dependent on seasonal streams and human-made wells, and many locations had no active wells. Wells could not be dug there. And there are no streams in that area that run to the Mediterranean all year long. So settlers hewed bell-shaped cisterns from bedrock in order to collect and store surplus water from the rainy winter for use during the arid summer. They dug channels to direct rainwater into the cistern. The cistern was bell-shaped with a narrow opening and then a large body within, and that protected the water from contamination or from evaporation. Some were dug in bedrock that was made of chalk, and the chalk formed a natural seal when it got wet. Others were sealed with a plaster compound, which kept water from seeping out into the bedrock. This was an enormous amount of work to save and store water. And this feature of life in Iron Age Israel provides the context and vehicle for Jeremiah's beautiful metaphor at the end of today's difficult reading. In our world, where water flows from taps and travels in plastic bottles, where drought means not that we thirst, but that we refrain from washing our cars and watering our lawns, and in the very worst case, crops far from us fail, raising our food prices marginally. In such a world, it is difficult to grasp the force of this metaphor. We have, most of us, always lived with water security and have had to give very little thought to the technologies and processes that make it possible. But this very distance from the source makes us all the more susceptible to the charges God levels against the house of Israel. What is this? What is this about? God as living, moving, constantly refreshing water, and us turning to dry, cracked cisterns. It's Jeremiah's familiar message of idolatry. And here Jeremiah hopes to have the people see it with fresh eyes. When we are caught in a time of idolatry, when we have made something other than God the center of our lives, it's sometimes impossible, I would say almost always impossible, to see that that's what we've done. We think that we are following something good. We don't set out to do evil. We don't set out to be uncentered from our true center. But that's how we often end up. We think that the things that we are following are good, even if they leave us feeling dry and empty, and they drain us of our energy. Jeremiah Jeremiah tells us that idolatry is the act of trusting in our own technologies, our own wisdom, our own creations, as we move further and further from the ground and source of our being. It leads us to forsake practices of justice and to forget to think about the very God who sustains and nourishes us as we work to master and take care of our environments, to conquer, to establish security for ourselves, and to develop newer and newer frontiers. When we exchange God for an idol, says Jeremiah, we are transformed. We become like what we pursue, temporary. If what we pursue is empty, we become empty. If what we pursue is vain, we become vain. I wonder what habits we have formed as a culture, as individuals, as a church community, as a church conference, that lead us away from the living water. What pursuits and temporary ambitions do we allow to fill our vision with a prize that will turn out to be a puff of smoke? I wonder if there are things in our culture that we ought to resist, and instead we acquiesce. And we let ourselves get led further and further from the source of our breath and life and joy. Technologies have reordered and reoriented our lives faster and faster and faster, so fast we can almost not examine them. And the things that are prized in our culture, the things that we are taught to prize about ourselves, vanish in a day. Living in a land where there is so much that we actually have to worry about the stress of choosing from all of the plenty. Do we allow all that plenty to fool us into thinking that we have no more need of God? The opening words of this passage, "Hear the word of the Lord, O house of Jacob, and all the families of the house of Israel," echo the well-known phrase, "Hear, O Israel," that begins the Shema prayer in Deuteronomy 6:4. The instruction contained in this prayer emphasizes the constant mindfulness and diligence that is required to maintain one's allegiance to the one God. Even at Sinai, when the people created their idol, God knew how easy it would be for the people to forget, to be distracted by comfort, boredom, anxiety, or ambition. And do we live in a culture that fosters all of those things? Boredom, anxiety, and ambition make false promises that somehow we must pay a price to them. Somehow, self-knowledge and self-expression have been traded in for the false gods of notoriety and wealth and fame. And these things are not the same. The humility that would lead us to trust in God has been defamed and twisted into self-abnegation, and then rightly mocked and tossed aside. This is not true humility. Self-loathing, which, if you're a woman in our culture, you've been taught self-loathing from the time you looked at the first magazine in the first grocery store aisle. So many messages teaching us not to love ourselves for who God created us to be, but for surface things that vanish in a day. We are constantly being enticed toward the religion of self above all else. It is a hollow one, and it will not satisfy forever. God calls us to revel in the knowledge of God's love, and then to rejoice in spreading that love. As the psalmist reminds us, it is well with those who deal generously and lend, those who seek justice, those who have distributed freely and given to the poor. God's commandments are not given to us to make us acceptable to God. We are already accepted. They are given to make us rooted and grounded in love. They are given to make us happy, and not just happy, but joyful. We are invited to let go of the pressure of our culture, which tells us to achieve, arrive, purchase, be big, be beautiful, be perfect. We are invited to let go of all of that pressure, and instead be humble and happy, to delight in the gifts we have been given. If you are excellent at something, delight in that and then share it. the things at which you are excel, the things at which, the gifts that you have been given, they are to be delighted in and then to be shared. Not because they reflect your worth, which is both immeasurable and unimportant, but because they are innately joyful. And they are to be shared with all of the others of us, whose worth is also immeasurable and unimportant. There was a young girl at my church, my former church, who had some tough family times, and she always wanted to be the center of attention. She needed it. She needed care. She needed to be the focus. She needed to know she was the most important little girl in the room. She also needed to know that so was everyone else in the room. And I don't think that lesson is different for me, or maybe for the rest of us. We all need to know that we are immeasurably loved, and so is everyone else. I was thinking of this this question of humility all week, and a poem by E.E. Cummings kept running through my mind over and over again. So thinking of our church, our beautiful, quirky, wonderful little church, I share this E.E. Cummings poem with you. I am a little church, no great cathedral. Far from the splendor and squalor of hurrying cities, I do not worry if briefer days grow briefest. I am not sorry when sun and rain make April. My life is the life of the reaper and the sower. My prayers are prayers of earth's own clumsily striving children, whose any sadness or joy is my grief or my gladness. Around me surges a miracle of unceasing birth and glory and death and resurrection. Over my sleeping self float flaming symbols of hope, and I wake to a perfect patience of mountains. I am a little church, far from the frantic world with its rapture and anguish, at peace with nature. I do not worry if longer nights grow longest. I am not sorry when silence becomes singing. Winter by spring, I lift my diminutive spire to merciful him whose only now is forever, standing erect in the deathless truth of his presence, welcoming humbly his light and proudly his darkness. Amen.
Listen, listen, listen.